We are coming to the slowly to the conclusion of the lecture series. This is really the last of our lectures. Our question was, do we have any more? No. Good. Oh, sorry, it's not so good. I shouldn't be. So, anyway, okay.
Więc cieszę się straszliwie, że jesteście Państwo tak licznie, bo spotkanie z Yossim Klein-Halevin to jest wielkie wydarzenie intelektualne, a wielka przyjemność duchowa dla nas, organizatorów, to jest naprawdę absolutny dar, że możemy go gościć dzisiaj, wczoraj, dzisiaj. Jest po raz pierwszy na festiwalu, ale zapewniam Państwa, że nie po raz ostatni. Właśnie rozmawialiśmy o czymś, o czym muszę Państwu powiedzieć i co zamierzam mówić jutro też z ulicy Szerokiej, na ulicy Szerokiej prowadząc koncert. Wiecie Państwo lub nie, a jeżeli nie, to za chwilkę się dowiecie, że w poniedziałek w Krakowie będzie się odbywało takie walne posiedzenie, zgromadzenie UNESCO. Znacie Państwo doskonale tę organizację. UNESCO wpisało m.in. Kazimierz na listę wspólnego dziedzictwa w 1978 roku. Jedna z ostatnich rezolucji podjęta przez UNESCO zaprzecza bardzo oczywistym, prostym faktom, o których tyle mówiliśmy podczas wykładów. Słyszeliście Państwo o tym, czy nie? Mianowicie UNESCO sobie wymyśliło, podążając za Arafatem i za wszystkimi tymi, którzy chcą zniszczyć i naród żydowski, i państwo żydowskie Izrael, i nade wszystko historię żydowską, że wzgórze świątynne, kotel, czyli kotel Hamarawi, czyli ściana płaczu mu zachodni, to nie jest święte miejsce judaizmu. To jest wyłącznie święte miejsce islamu. Ja nie wiem, Goebbels też tak mówił. Do tego stopnia, aż wreszcie wszyscy uwierzyli. Więc ja musiałem to powiedzieć, bo jestem Polakiem, bo jestem dyrektorem tego festiwalu i z głębi swojej duszy się nie zgadzam. Rzadko mówię o polityce, ale to wszystko i tak nas dotyczy. Kupowanie chałki dzisiaj było też polityką, bo pani próbowała mi uświadomić przez cały czas, że to nie jest chałka, tylko sztrucla. Ja mówię, to nie jest sztrucla, to jest chałka. To co pan chce, chałkę czy sztrucle? Bo chałka to jest słodka. Ja mówię, chcę chałkę, ale taką tę właśnie nie słodką. Nie, to jest sztrucla. A skąd pani jest? No nie, chciałem powiedzieć, z jakiej partii pani była. Nieważne. I'm sorry, I was confused, you know. I bought challah today, early morning in a bakery, very nice bakery. So I said, can I get this challah? And I pointed out. She said, this is not challah. She said, this is sztrucla. I said, why sztrucla? This is challah. And she said, no, challah is a sweet one, and this wasn't is sztrucla. So I said many times that I need the challah. Finally, she, you know, it costs a lot of money, so she sold it. But it's unbelievable. Well, co się dzieje na tym świecie? Mówmy prawdę, bo tylko prawda nas zbliża, kłamstwo nas dzieli. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I make it very short. So we are so proud as organizers of a Jewish culture festival in Krakow, which we've been done for 29 years, that yesterday and today we can host this amazing, fantastic person, Yossi Klein-Halevi, who is going to share with you his knowledge about Israel. Israel, which you know, is in the center of our mind, and especially Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, as Yerushalayim is the center of the world, Yerushalayim is the center of the Jewish culture festival in Krakow. Yerushalayim, she was, she is, and she always will be. And just mention only a few words about the resolution of UNESCO, because UNESCO is going to govern one day after the finish of the Jewish culture festival. And you perfectly know what UNESCO, what UNESCO's one of the last resolutions says, that the Temple Mount, the Kotel Hamaravi, doesn't belong to the Jewish people. It belongs only to the Muslim people. So they denied our right to our holy place in Yerushalayim. They denied our right to our history. They ruins everything that we are trying to build. I don't understand it. I disagree. And I'm going to say it openly. The Jewish Culture Festival supports Israel. The Jewish Culture Festival supports Yerushalayim. The Jewish Culture Festival reflects the real history of the Jewish people. So I'm more than proud that we host this day Yossi Klein Halevi, who is a representative of Israel, of Yerushalayim, of the history of Jewish people. Thank you very much.
Janosz, thank you. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Now, Janosz, thank you very much for your personal friendship and for your friendship and love for the Jewish people in Israel, and it's completely reciprocated. So, dzień dobry. That was okay. The pronunciation was okay. That's all the Polish you're going to hear from me today. So I'm really delighted to be here and very moved. This is my first Jewish Culture Festival. And as I told Janosz, this is, to my mind, the highest level Jewish Culture Festival that I've seen anywhere in the world. So as we say in Hebrew, kol hakavod, which means really just well done, a job well done. And thank you. Thank you very much. So yesterday, I had a conversation here with my friend Stasha Krajewski, and for those of you who weren't here, I would just like to briefly sum up one of the points that we touched on. Stasha asked me about my personal relationship with Israel, with Jerusalem, and my first visit to Israel, you can hear from my accent that I'm American-born. And my first visit to Israel was as a 14-year-old boy in the late June 1967, 3 weeks after the end of the Six-Day War. I came to Israel with my father, who was a Holocaust survivor from Hungary. My father had two brothers who had survived the war who were living in Israel, and he had not seen them since the Holocaust. And as soon as the Six-Day War was over, he said, that's it, we're going, we have to be in Israel. And that was really the summer of Jewish unity. Israel was in a state of euphoria. There had been, in the weeks leading up to the Six-Day War, a very strong fear among Israelis and Jews around the world that Israel might be destroyed by the Arab nations who were surrounding it and openly predicting the coming destruction of Israel. And instead, Israel, of course, won its greatest military victory and found itself in possession of United Jerusalem. The next significant date for me in terms of my relationship to Israel is the summer of 1982, when I returned to Israel, this time as an immigrant, with my wife Sarah, who was then my girlfriend. We married a year later. And Israel in the summer of 1982 was the anti-Six-Day War. It was the exact opposite. It was the antithesis of Israel in the summer of 1967. The summer of 1982 was the summer of Israel's Lebanon War, the first Lebanon War, when we were more divided than we had ever been before, and we were divided by war. That had never happened before in Israel. In Israel, war, the security threats, always united the people of Israel. And now suddenly, rather than unite us, the war is tearing us apart. Should we have invaded Lebanon? Should we have restrained ourselves? This was tearing apart Israeli society. And Sarah and I we're joining Israel at its most divisive moment, really its lowest point. And I realized very early on that as a new immigrant, I had two choices. there were two ways in which I could join this society. I could either choose one of the ideological camps that was tearing Israel apart. I could choose to become a part of left-wing secular Israel, which was the peace movement, which was the movement against the settlements, or I could choose to join the Israel of the settlements, hawkish Israel, the Israel of the Likud. And many of my friends who came from America around that same time really did join one of those two Israels. And it was a strategy that really made sense for a new immigrant, because if you're joining a country that's tearing itself apart, then where do you go? Which Israel do you join? But I realized that there's another option that I had as a new immigrant, which is to join Israeli society in its whole, in its complexity, in its divisiveness. And to join Israeli society meant for me being open to all of the different ideas across the Israeli political and cultural spectrum. And Israel, as some of you may know, Israel is divided along multiple schisms. There is the religious secular schism. There's the schism between the Jews who come from Arab countries and the Jews who have European origin. There, of course, is the schism between those who are for redividing the territories and those who are for settling the territories, the West Bank. There is the division between the Arab Israelis and the Jewish Israelis, even leaving the Palestinians aside, the citizens, the Arab citizens of Israel and the Jewish citizens of Israel. And so what really intrigued me about Israeli society was the opportunity to discover all of these different ideas about Israel. All of the different ideas that the Jews had brought back to Israel from all of our wanderings around the world. And so the question that I asked myself as a new immigrant was perhaps a strange question in the context of other national identities, but a very natural question in the context of Israeli identity, and that is, what is Israel? What is Israel? And I think that one of the reasons why, when I think of my colleagues in the media who come to report from abroad, who come to Israel, and so often get Israel wrong, have this very simplistic, superficial idea of Israel, it's because Israel is so hard to understand, precisely because it is so complicated, because there are so many different Israels. There are so many different ideas about what is Israel. And just think for a moment about Israel's place in the world. I would argue that on the one hand, there is no country in the world that has more enemies than Israel, that is more actively hated than Israel. There is a whole movement around the world to boycott Israel, a movement that doesn't exist toward any other country. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, I would argue that Israel has more active friends around the world than any other country. Now, it's true that Israel needs those friends, and that helps. It helps to explain why so many people around the world have mobilized for Israel. But wherever I go around the world, I meet people who actively love Israel, as we just heard here from Janosz. And so there's something on the one hand about Israel that brings out this tremendous hatred, and on the other hand, tremendous love. So the paradox of Israel is built into, first of all, how the international community relates to Israel. It used to be said of India, and maybe for all I know it's still true, that any statement that you make about India, the opposite statement is true as well. And I think that that is true for Israel. So, what is Israel? According to the Israeli Declaration of Independence, which is as close to a constitution as we have, the founders of Israel defined the state as a Jewish state and a democratic state. Now, what does that mean? For me, it means that on the one hand, Israel is the homeland of every Jew in the world, whether or not he or she lives in Israel, whether or not he or she is a citizen of Israel. And on the other hand, Israel is the state of all of its citizens, whether or not they are Jewish. So that's a very complicated identity to navigate, and that is the foundational paradox of Israel. Is Israel a secular state? Is Israel a religious state? Well, first of all, it depends where you're standing when you ask the question. If you're in Tel Aviv, Israel is absolutely a secular state. Israel is San Francisco of the Middle East. In fact, we just had not just the biggest gay pride parade in the Middle East, the only gay pride parade in the Middle East, except that we also have one in Jerusalem and Haifa. But Israel, in that sense, seen from Tel Aviv, Israel is a militantly secular society. Seen from Jerusalem, Israel could not possibly be more religious. There seems to be a synagogue or a study hall every half block. My definition of Israel in terms of the relationship between secular and religious is that Israel is a secular state in the Holy Land, which means that it cannot be completely secular because of where it is, where it exists. And that creates permanent tensions that are built into Israel's identity. There can never be a final resolution to the question of whether Israel is a secular state or a religious state. We will continue to define our culture war by this question of the relationship between secular and religious. And it has created, by founding a secular state in the Holy Land, we have condemned ourselves to a permanent culture war that can never be resolved. Is Israel a Western state? Is it an Eastern state? Yes, it's both. Israel was founded by Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe, most of them socialist revolutionaries. But today, Israel is increasingly Eastern. It increasingly reflects the culture, the sensibilities, the politics of Jews who come from the Middle East. I would argue that a majority of Israeli Jews today have some family origin in the Middle East for the simple reason that more and more Jews from either Europe or the Middle East are marrying each other. It's what we call intermarriage in Israel. And the intermarriage between Jews from the Middle East and Jews who have European origin is now such a commonplace event that I don't even know if there are statistics anymore. When Sarah and I first moved to Israel, there would be statistics in the newspaper. How many Jews are marrying each other from Ashkenazi origin and from Mizrahi origin? I haven't seen those statistics in years. And so Israel is a meeting point between East and West, not always an easy meeting point, but this is really one of the essential stories of Israel. When I speak about Israel as a series of paradoxes, East, West, religious, secular, Jewish state, democratic state, let me present to you a series of statements which I think will really emphasize the point of the paradoxes that define Israeliness. Statement number one. Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Israelis are justifiably proud of that fact. We are, in my understanding, we are a kind of a laboratory for democracy in a condition of permanent extremity, permanent crisis. There's no other democracy that I know of that was born in war and siege and has remained in that condition since its founding. So that Israel is really a test case for what happens to a democracy when extreme pressure is applied on it nonstop. And in that sense, when you think of Israel as a kind of laboratory for democracy under extreme conditions, Israel's democratic failures are as instructive, as valuable for study as Israel's democratic achievements. So statement number one, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Statement number two, Israel is the only democracy in the world that is also a long-term occupier of another people. So what do we do with that statement? What do we do with statement number one and statement number two? Does statement number two mean that statement number one is not valid? Well, Israel does have extraordinary democratic institutions. It has the most activist Supreme Court probably in the world. It has a free press that is so anti-establishment that sometimes Israelis reading their own newspapers wonder if they're reading an Israeli newspaper. And yet, this same society has been an occupier of another people for 50 years without any indication of any sign that this occupation is ending anytime soon. So those are the first two statements. Statement number three, just to complicate the picture even more. Israel is the only occupier that I know of, maybe in history, that fears that if it ends the occupation, it will not merely be diminished territorially, but might find itself in a position where it may not be able to defend itself against existential threat in the most unstable region in the world. Statement number four, Israel is the only country in the world against which a death sentence, a permanent death sentence, has been taken out against it by many of its neighbors. Now, as an Israeli citizen, I don't know what to do with these four statements. I have lived in Israel now for 35 years. I have worked as a journalist. I've been a soldier. I've been an occupier. I've been active in reconciliation efforts between Palestinians and Israelis. And I don't know how to make sense of these four statements. Are we a democracy? Are we an occupier? Do we have an alternative to occupation in the situation we're in the Middle East? My answer to all of the above questions is, I don't know. When I think of Israel, when I say that the essence of Israel, the way to understand Israel, is through its paradoxes, these series of contradictions, that isn't only a reflection of the policy contradictions that we face, but more deeply, I believe that paradox is built in to the essence of Israeli identity. Because when you create a society that brings in immigrants from 100 different countries around the world, You are inviting you are inviting Jews to come back and to bring all of their contradictory ideas and fears and expectations that we gathered in our wanderings around the world back to our point of origin. That is the excitement of the Israeli story. We started in this point of origin in that land. We went out into the entire world, east, west, north, south, and we have come back and we've brought everything that we've learned in our wanderings and everything that we expected for 2,000 years when we fantasized about what it would be like when we finally returned home. Every Jewish community had a different idea of what it would be like when we came back. And we returned with opposite expectations of what a Jewish state would be like. So, for me, as an example, I grew up in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s, which was a very particular time to grow up in America, a very exciting time. And I absorbed the sense of expansiveness of American society of the 60s and 70s. America was just then beginning to look at its own history in a very courageous and painful way, looking at the failures of its history. And America was on its way to trying to become a much better democracy than it had been for its history. And so that was my growing up. When I moved to Israel and I saw Israeli democracy, I said, okay, now it's Israel's turn. We need to go through some very painful self-examination. We need to go through that same courageous process that America went through in the 1960s and 70s. And my expectation is that Israel will become more pluralistic and more democratic, not less. One of my great fears as an Israeli citizen, when I see the consequences of 50 years of occupation, is the erosion of democratic norms and attitudes on the part of young Israelis. This keeps me awake at night. Now, that's my experience as an American Jew growing up when I did. Now, I have friends from the former Soviet Union who moved to Israel and whose experiences were the exact opposite of mine. I grew up in the safest Jewish community in history, in a Jewish community that welcomed Jews to participate in the public space, that saw American Jews as integral to American culture, American politics. My friends from the former Soviet Union grew up in a totalitarian, anti-Semitic regime. Their biggest fear is that Israel will find itself in a situation where we are so concerned about democratic niceties that we will emasculate ourselves. We won't be able to adequately defend ourselves. There was an event that happened a few months ago in Israel, some of you may know it, where an Israeli soldier shot and killed a Palestinian terrorist after he had been disarmed and was lying on the ground. And the army put him on trial and sentenced him to 5 years in prison for violating the norms of the Israeli army. Now, as an American-born Israeli, I was very proud of my army. But my friends from the Soviet Union, or Jews who I know whose families come from Iraq or Syria or Yemen, say, are we crazy? We are going to put one of our kids in jail for 5 years for killing a terrorist? Isn't that what we're sending them to the army to do? And if we keep doing this, we're going to lose our motivation to defend ourselves. We're going to be sending a disastrous message to the Middle East, which will not see this as a sign of the strength of Israeli society, but quite the opposite, as a sign of weakness. And so this divide goes to the heart of the consequences of bringing in Jews who have had radically different experiences. I served in the Israeli army in the period that we call the First Intifada. I was drafted in the late 1980s, and my unit was sent into the Gaza refugee camps. And I had two friends who I was particularly close with. We were a reservist unit. Most of us were in our 30s already. We were family men, and the army created a unit of new immigrants. And among my friends were two, as it happens, my two closest friends were two African Jews. One from South Africa, one from Ethiopia. And as we're going through our very, for me, very traumatic experiences in the Gaza refugee camps, my friend from South Africa was becoming more and more depressed. Because he said, this is what I came to Israel to get away from, and I feel that I'm back in South Africa. That was his emotional response to Gaza. My friend from Ethiopia had exactly the opposite experience. He said, look at the graffiti on the wall in the refugee camps, which shows a Star of David and a dagger with blood dripping out of the Star of David. And his conclusion was, they want to destroy us. It's us or them. It's not two states for two peoples. It's one state for one people. It's either going to be us or it will be the Palestinians. And he said, I am not going back to the refugee camp in the Sudan where we were. And so his response was to become more and more hardline. Two African Jews, the same military service, completely opposite conclusions based on their own experiences from where they came from. What I often feel in Israel is that Jewish history is arguing with itself. And what we're arguing about is, who are we? We have a 4,000-year story. What does it mean? How are we supposed to behave now that we are a sovereign people again with power? How are we supposed to behave toward the Palestinians? Are we supposed to behave with generosity? Remember, as the Bible says, that you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Don't treat others the way you were treated. That would be a left-wing Israeli position. A right-wing Israeli position is to say, wait a minute, the Palestinian national movement doesn't accept our legitimacy. It doesn't accept our right to exist in this land. It isn't interested in sharing the land with us, but in dispossessing us. And so, what is Jewish history teaching us? Don't be naive. If you have enemies who say they want to destroy you, believe them. Even if they don't have power against you now, don't give them the power. Don't give them a state, so they will then have a base from which to try to destroy you. That's the right-wing Israeli argument. These are very powerful arguments, and they're particularly powerful because they come out of the deepest place in the Jewish experience. What I've learned as an Israeli is that no ideology within Israel, no group of Jews, no Jewish community has any monopoly on the wisdom of Jewish history. All of these different groups, left, right, secular, religious, all of these groups are speaking some essential truth that comes from their experience, that comes from Jewish history. Till what time do we have? Do we have till 3? It's now 2:30. So we have till about 3. Yes, is that right? 1 hour. Okay. So let me try to conclude then with the Palestinian question, and then we can open up for conversation. Because paradox not only defines our internal domestic issues, but I would say that paradox is really at the heart of the Israeli dilemma about what to do with the Palestinians. A majority of Israelis today are neither left-wing nor right-wing, but a mixture of both. A little bit left-wing and a little bit right-wing. And the result is at the center. And I would define a majority of Israelis today very much as being part of an amorphous center. And this center believes two things about a Palestinian state. First of all, that a Palestinian state is an existential need for Israel. It is a life and death necessity for us. Never mind the Palestinians for a moment. Israel needs a Palestinian state. The reason we need a Palestinian state is because if we continue with the occupation for another generation, then we will have to choose between the two essential identities of Israel, which is Israel as a Jewish majority state and Israel as a democratic state. If we continue to try to forcibly absorb the Palestinian population into Israel, we will sooner or later lose the Jewish majority. And at that moment, we can't have it both ways. We can't both be a Jewish majority state and a democracy. We're going to have to choose. And Israel, which is not a Jewish majority state and a democratic state, is not Israel anymore. It will lose half of its people. It will lose that half that sees democracy as more important, and it will lose the other half that sees Jewishness as more important, if we're not both simultaneously. And so, for all those reasons and more, for moral reasons, to prevent the further moral erosion of Israeli society, sooner or later, we are going to have to create a Palestinian state. And the way that I would put it even more strongly is that if Israel does not have a negotiating partner on the other side for a two-state solution, we should not allow that to be a kind of a veto power against saving ourselves as a Jewish and democratic state. And so in the way that we unilaterally withdrew from Gaza in 2005 without waiting for a peace partner on the Palestinian side, many Israelis believe that sooner or later we may have to do the same thing in the West Bank to save Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. So that's the left-wing side of a centrist Israeli. And I'm speaking now very much as a centrist myself. The right-wing side of a centrist persona is that a Palestinian state is potentially an existential threat to Israel. If you look at Israeli geography, the thought of Israel going back to the borders that we had in May 1967, just before the Six-Day War, where at its narrowest point, Israel is 8 or 9 miles wide, to go back to those borders with the West Bank, which is a hill, it's hill country, overlooking the flat plain of the Israeli coastal, of the Israeli coast, Tel Aviv, from Tel Aviv to Haifa, it's a flat plain under the hills of the West Bank. If Hamas, for example, were to take over the West Bank, and most Israelis believe, according to a poll that was just in the paper the other day, a majority of Israelis, close to 70%, believe that if there's a Palestinian state in the West Bank, Hamas will take over, then we are facing a situation where we really may not be able to defend ourselves, where rockets could be falling on Ben Gurion Airport on a regular basis, and Israel might not be able to function as a normal society. And so the centrist is caught in that paradox of a Palestinian state as a life and death necessity for Israel and a life and death threat. Put it another way, an Israeli centrist has two nightmares about a Palestinian state. The first nightmare is that there won't be a Palestinian state. The occupation continues another generation. Israel becomes more and more of a pariah state around the world. The delicate balance between our two identities as a Jewish and democratic state starts to unravel. And the second nightmare is that there will be a Palestinian state. And I would argue that if you were to be able to have a private conversation with Prime Minister Netanyahu, my strong sense is that he would say something similar, that he has two nightmares, that there won't be a Palestinian state and that there will be. And I think that that explains why Israel is in this place of status quo for so long, where we are in effect stalemated against ourselves, because the possibilities, either possibility, is too frightening. I'll conclude by offering an idea of how a final status agreement between Israel and the Palestinians might look conceptually. And I'm not speaking now about a line on the map, but really in terms of the idea of a two-state solution, because that too needs to be based on a certain paradox. And the paradox is that between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, that little piece of land that is the state of Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, that piece of land is, conceptually speaking, two territories, not one. It is the land of Israel and it is the land of Palestine. For me, as an Israeli, as a religious Jew, the West Bank is not the West Bank. It is Judea and Samaria. It is the heart of the land of Israel. The West Bank city of Hebron, Hebron in Hebrew, is for me the most Jewish city in the world. Maybe Krakow is the second. But Hebron is the most Jewish city, more than Jerusalem. Hebron has had a Jewish presence on and off for 4,000 years. Abraham and Sarah and their children are buried in Hebron. And so when I go to Hebron, I feel that I am in the deepest place of my being. The problem is there's another people that I'm sharing this land with. I wish they weren't there, and they wish that I wasn't there. We're both there, and neither people, as far as I can see, is leaving. And so, for the Palestinians, the land between the river and the sea is all theirs, in the same way that I believe that the land between the river and the sea is all mine. From the subjective point of view of Jewish history, Jewish identity, that little land is all mine. And just as from the subjective point of view of the Palestinians, that little land is all theirs. And so when I speak to Palestinians, very often they'll say, you know, Haifa, which is in the state of Israel, Haifa isn't, for me, isn't Israel, it's Palestine. And if you look at the maps that the Palestinian Authority has in its offices, in its schools, those maps do not show the state of Israel. It's all Palestine. And my response is, you know, you're right. Haifa belongs to you. The problem is that Hebron belongs to me. And so if the state of Israel belongs to you and the West Bank belongs to me, we have a problem. And we have one of two possible solutions. The first is that we continue our 100-year war for another 100 years. And one side or the other, sooner or later, will win. Either we'll go back to the sea, or the Palestinians will go to the desert. That's one possibility. The second possibility is that we do what neither side really wants to do, and what neither side regards as just, and that is that we cut this little land into pieces, this little beloved land into two little states. The international community, and especially the diplomats who've tried to bring peace for years, have never understood that partition of this little land is not seen by the two peoples who will have to do the partition as an act of justice, but it is seen as an act of injustice. For me to conceive of the state of Israel without Hebron, after we won Hebron in the most just war that I believe any country could possibly fight, which is the war, the Six-Day War, where Israel was defending itself against a war of attempted destruction, and we come back to our ancestral land, for me to have to give that up is an act of deep injustice, a violation against Jewish history. But I have no choice. And for the Palestinians to have to give up Haifa or Jaffa, the Galilee, to the State of Israel, to Jews who've come from Poland and America and India and Ethiopia and Iraq and Yemen, is an act of deep injustice. And I understand them. From their point of view, they're right. Just as from my point of view, I'm right. From my point of view, I see no difference between a settler who lives in Hebron and an Israeli who lives in Tel Aviv. The only difference is that the Jew in Hebron has a deeper historical claim, because Hebron is only Tel Aviv is 100 years old. It's a baby city. And so, if we are going to reach an agreement, the paradox is that both sides need to impose an act of injustice on their own identity, on their own conception of history. Each side needs to contract its claim to this same little piece of land. My vision, my hope of what an eventual peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinian people will look like is that a peace agreement will initially be greeted by both sides with mourning as a tragedy. And you know, in Jewish tradition, we have fast days that commemorate certain historical events. And I believe that we will have a fast day in the future for having lost Judea and Samaria. But the day after that fast day will be a day of celebration of peace, God willing. So let's open for a conversation. Thank you. Dziękuję. So please, let's questions, comments. A very polite audience. If this were an Israeli audience, I would be getting people shouting at me now. How could you possibly say that? So, yes, did you have your? Yes, please.
This week I read your article about Woman of the Wall and how it was an affront to Zionism. I believe that's what you said. Could you elaborate on that? I've been reading a lot of articles about how it's unfair for American Jewry to expect Israel to automatically give it a place when it's not doing enough, and you know they don't understand the reality of Israel, that they're all the way there, they're not contributing to Israel, but they expect to have a place carved up for them. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to this, and can you tell us about your opinion?
Yeah, great, thank you. Just to give you a background on the question, maybe many of you know this, but the latest uproar in Israel, we have what we call the scandal of the week, and the latest uproar is that the government had. Well, I'll take it a step back. The Western Wall basically functions as an Orthodox synagogue, which is to say that there is separation for prayer between men and women, as you would have in an Orthodox synagogue. The liberal Jewish denominations, the Reform and the Conservative denominations, want a part of the wall where they can have egalitarian prayer, where men and women can pray together. And the government of Israel negotiated an agreement which supposedly everybody had accepted, including the Orthodox, that a part of the wall would be allocated for egalitarian prayer. Now, under pressure from the ultra-Orthodox parties, the government rescinded, reneged on its agreement, and this has created a major rift with American Jewry in particular, because a majority of American Jews are either Reform or Conservative. In Israel, Reform and Conservative Judaism is very small. And so it isn't a big priority for most Israeli Jews, but it is a major priority for American Jews. And the article that you're referring to that I wrote a few days ago said that the one of the essential identities of Israel, and I mentioned this earlier, is as the homeland of the Jewish people. And that's very much an idea that comes out of classical religious Judaism, and it also comes out of Zionism. And Zionism, to my understanding of Zionism, is that it is the affirmation of Jewish peoplehood. So that any of our subsidiary Jewish identities, if I'm a religious Jew, the noun is Jew, religious is the adjective. If I'm a secular Jew, the adjective is secular. If I'm Reform, if I'm ultra-Orthodox, those are adjectives. And Israel has defined peoplehood as the essential identity, the neutral ground that, in principle, unites all Jews. The Western Wall is our most important contemporary religious symbol, but it is also our most important contemporary symbol of peoplehood. It's the symbol that unites Jews whether or not they're religious. And so, or whether, certainly whether or not they're Orthodox. And so there needs to be, to my mind, some way in which all Jews can feel that the public space in Israel and the symbols of Israeli sovereignty reflect who they are as Jews. And can accommodate that diversity. And so by handing over veto power to the ultra-Orthodox over how prayer happens at the wall, and the wall is a long space, it can accommodate this diversity, but to allow the ultra-Orthodox to effectively veto the nature of the relationship of the Jewish people to this space is, to my mind, a deep violation of the Zionism of peoplehood. So I hope that's clear. Yes.
Can you expand on one term and one fact that I want to mention just to make the picture complete? The term is legal occupation. That shows how complex the thing is, because I've heard that whatever Israel is occupying, if one can occupy one's own land, it's legal in the light of international law. Have you read about it?
Yes.
It's one thing. The other thing is, because it's missing from media are manipulating as much as they can, and I live in Sweden where it is most often, when it happens most often. So the fact that the other state, the state for Palestinians, has already been offered, but it was, the terms were rejected, or it was rejected, because it's important to know about legal occupation and rejection by Palestinians. I would like to mention many other things, how unnegotiable are Palestinians, because what they do with their children, what they teach them, and but maybe it's not needed here.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the question. In terms of the Palestinian leadership's rejection of two-state plans that were offered, I can't think of another national movement that has rejected more offers for compromise for statehood than the Palestinian leadership. Going back to 1937, 1947, the year 2000, when the Palestinian leadership rejected two American negotiated offers for a two-state solution. So when I speak about the occupation, I have to tell you, in all honesty, I don't feel like a guilty occupier. I used to. In the 1990s, I was very much a guilty Israeli. But when the Palestinian leadership in the year 2000 rejected the Camp David negotiations with Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and then the Clinton proposals 6 months later, which would have given the Palestinians almost 100% of the land and redivided Jerusalem, and then went to war for 4 years. We had the suicide bombings after Israel had accepted two offers for a Palestinian state. That's when I and many other Israelis like me, who I call the camp of the guilty Israelis, that's when we lost our guilt. So when I speak today about the need for a Palestinian state, I'm really speaking about this from an Israeli perspective, that I need a Palestinian state to free me from the consequences to my society of occupying another people. Now, in terms of the legal consequences here, I'm really not the person to offer any learned response, but I can tell you just in very basic terms what I know, which is that most of the international community, most of the international expertise on law, as far as it relates to Israel's presence in the West Bank, defines us as an occupation. The Israeli government obviously sees this differently. There are some legal opinions that I know of that are the minority opinion that says that Israel is not an occupier, first of all, because there was never a Palestinian state in that territory. It had been occupied by Jordan until 1967, and Jordan's presence in the West Bank was never legally recognized. So Israel in effect took the West Bank from an occupier. But the question really of whether Israel is an occupier in the West Bank or not legally doesn't interest me personally as much, because I feel that whether we are recognized or not by the international community, I know that I'm not an occupier in any part of the land of Israel. That's something that is my subjective experience. And that in the same way that I am asking the Palestinian leadership to give up part of the land of Palestine that they believe belongs to them so that the state of Israel can continue to exist, I'm going to have to give up part of the land of Israel, which is the West Bank, so that a state of Palestine can exist. But that means that both sides are giving up part of what is theirs. And that's very different than saying that I'm an occupier and I'm not giving up anything. I'm not giving up anything that belongs to me. I'm just giving back. But I don't, from my point of view, I'm not giving back. I'm giving up territory. And that to me is a prerequisite for a fair agreement, because both sides feel that they're giving up something that belongs to them.
Back.
Having said what you said about the necessity of creating Palestinian state in the future, one of the nightmares, but also one of the hopes from your perspective, but people can create something that depends on them. And here, as you said, and I know this history, quite many times there was the rejection on the Palestinian side of the creating state. Actually, they said very openly that they're interested not so much in creating their state, as most nationalist movements in history were, as in destroying Israel. They are not that much interesting. They could belong to Jordan, but under the condition that there won't be Israel. So is there really a way of dealing with the question that it's not two peoples that want the territory, each one for themselves, even the same territory, that happened in history many times, but the question of two different goals for the people, for one of the existence with their neighbors peacefully if possible, the other one of really destroying and not of gaining anything for themselves?
I think that is, for me as an Israeli, that is the question. And I would approach any resumption of negotiations with the assumption that I am facing a Palestinian leadership that is not negotiating real peace, but a ceasefire, that is looking to gain territory and possibly using that territory as a base to try to expand for the next stage. So if you would have asked me the question until recently, do you see any chance for a two-state solution anytime soon? My answer would have been no. What's changed for me in the last year or two is the situation in the region. And that is that we are seeing the emergence, possibly, of a new alliance in the Middle East between Israel and the Sunni countries against Iran, Hezbollah, Syria, Hamas, against that alliance. And you know, we joke in Israel that we've discovered that Israel is a Sunni Jewish state. And right now there's a very interesting strategic relationship that's emerging between Israel and Saudis and the Gulf states and Egypt and Jordan around this issue of stopping Iranian expansionism. Bear in mind that Iran today effectively controls four Arab countries. It effectively controls Iraq, it controls Lebanon through Hezbollah, Yemen through the Houthis, who have recently taken over, and Syria through Assad. So Iran is in control of four Sunni countries. And this is something that the international community is almost completely ignoring. They're missing this. And Israel is a beneficiary of Sunni panic toward Iran. Now, for the first time, we're starting to explore the possibility of a regional negotiation over a Palestinian state. In other words, if it's just Israel and the Palestinians, it's not going to go anywhere. But if you bring in the Saudis and the Gulf states, who have a lot to offer both Israel and the Palestinians, economically, in terms of normalization for the Palestinians, in terms of development, suddenly the picture is looking more interesting, more complicated. And, you know, Israelis have, in our brain, we have a split screen when we think of the conflict. On one side of the screen, Israel is Goliath and the Palestinians are David. The other side of the screen, Israel is David and the Arab and Muslim world is Goliath. And so Israelis go back and forth when we think about, that's another paradox, when we think about our situation in relation to the conflict and to the region, Israel is both Goliath and David at the same time. If we bring the region in, and the region and the Arab world is willing to sponsor Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, then Israel can begin to look at itself as a Goliath in relation to the Palestinians and to think about negotiating an agreement that's much less frightening to us, even given the assumption that the Palestinians don't want a two-state solution and don't want peace. If you bring in the region, they may not have a choice. And there is some thinking in Israeli strategic and political circles that sees a two-state solution as being imposed on the Palestinian leadership by the Arab world. Now, that's a very optimistic scenario. Is it possible? Can it happen? As we say in the Middle East, God is great. We don't know. What time is it now? Is anyone keeping track? Three. So I think we'll take one last question if there is, and then we'll call it a day. Yes, please.
Pytanie trochę hipotetyczne.
A hypothetical question. What could Palestinians do if Palestinian state were to emerge? Now, what Israeli Palestinians, people with citizenship, would they stay in the occupied territories or would they go to a Palestinian state or another Arab state? It's about Palestinian identity.
Both of them.
The question is theoretical. If we think that the Palestinian state already exists, what would the Palestinians who live in Israel do? Would they live in the Palestinian state, or would they prefer to live in the Israel which occupies Palestine or whatever?
Well, you know, I about 10 years ago, maybe a little more by now, Ariel Sharon was the prime minister, and he suggested creating two states, and he was the first Likud prime minister to suggest this, to accept a Palestinian state. And he said that the Arab-Israeli areas, especially those that border the West Bank, can be annexed by a Palestinian state. They will lose their Israeli citizenship, but they don't have to leave their homes. They'll stay in their homes, but they will become citizens of Palestine. And I went to, I was working in those years as a journalist, and I went to interview people from this area, Arab-Israeli citizens. And this particular area is a center of the Islamic movement, the movement in Israel that is very close to Hamas in its ideology. And I went to meet the mayor of the largest town in this area called Umm el-Fahem, and the mayor was part of this Islamic movement, pro-Hamas movement. And I said to him, why don't you accept Sharon's solution? You don't want to be Israeli. You don't want to be an Arab minority in a Jewish state. You can stay in your home and you will be part of a Palestinian majority state. All you have to do is exchange passports. You give up your Israeli passport, you'll have a Palestinian passport. And he said to me, that would be worse than the Holocaust. And so if you're asking, would Arab Israelis insist on staying in a state in the state of Israel? Absolutely. Absolutely. The polls show overwhelmingly. Look, there was a poll taken recently of Arab Israelis, and I think the number was 52% said that they were proud to be Israeli. Now that's extraordinary given the very difficult situation that Arab Israelis are in. It's not easy being a minority in a Jewish state that's at war with the Palestinian people and with your own people. They're in a very complicated situation, and yet 52% today say that they are proud to be Israeli. If we resolve this issue to one extent or another, then I would expect that those numbers to substantially rise. I think that Israel needs an Arab minority. We are in the Middle East. Potentially, the Arab minority can help Israel, can be a bridge to the Middle East, can help Israel integrate into the Arab world eventually. I don't believe that Israel can remain an isolated enclave separate from the Middle East. And my deep belief in terms of Zionism, the meaning of Zionism, is that it brought the Jewish people back home, but back home is not only the land of Israel, home is also the Middle East, and eventually we need to find our place in the Middle East. So thank you all very much. A pleasure to be with you.